You are listening to the podcast Stošestka from Transparency International, Czech Republic. In today's episode, we will talk about money in US politics. My name is Lucia Vilimovská and our guest is Scott Greytek, who is Director of Advocacy for the US Office, Transparency International. So Scott, I don't want to go too deeply into the elections themselves, but I think we should provide to our listeners a short introduction into the US situation. Who can vote and who do I vote for as a voter?
So in the United States, we have our federal elections, which is for obviously president, for members of Congress, which is split into two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate, which is our upper chamber. And to vote in those elections, you have to be at least 18 years old before or on the day of the election. You have to be a U.S. citizen. You have to be a resident of a state. And all 50 states have different rules about who is a resident, what it takes to be a resident. And then most importantly, you have to be registered to vote. And again, almost every state, there's one state that doesn't require you to register to vote, but all the others have rules about how to become a registered voter. If you meet those requirements, you're over 18, you're a US citizen, you're a resident of a state, and you're registered to vote in that state, then you're able to vote for all three of those offices, members of Congress, Senate, House of Representatives, and US President.
Republican majority state legislatures across the country are moving rapidly to pass new voting laws amid former President Donald Trump's continued false claims of election fraud. Lisa Desjardins takes us to one battleground state and explains the raging debate.
Vote no on HB 531.
In Georgia this week, the sounds of American democracy still struggling and over an essential trait, voting itself.
This is what democracy looks like.
Outside the state house, protesters chant about access, fearful their ability to vote is under threat.
All those in favor?
Inside, the Republican-led legislature says the issue is security, pushing sweeping bills to rewrite state voting laws, blaming 2020.
Well, isn't it unless you are a felon? Because there has been an ongoing debate about voting rights in the US. For example, just recently, I've noticed that Georgia has passed restrictions on voting rights. Does everybody have a vote in the US? And also, as a voter, which elections I can participate in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. So baseline and generally, the four conditions that I mentioned are what you know, somebody has to be able to satisfy in order to be eligible to vote. But you're right, there are all sorts of other conditions and restrictions and barriers to the ballot box, especially this last year, that states have imposed on their voters. So in the United States, yes, Congress and the federal government, they're responsible for setting up the general framework for US elections, who gets to vote in them. But then much of that decision-making about, you know, are the restrictions if you are a felon? And, you know, some states say if you are a convicted felon, you will never be able to vote again. There are other states that say even if you are currently incarcerated, you're currently in prison in a state, you have the right to vote. There are others that require you to prove your identity in order to be able to vote. Those are called voter ID laws. There are two states that require that you be a citizen of the United States in order to vote in their state elections. So there is a huge variety of laws that different states have passed when it comes to who can vote in their elections and even how they vote in those elections, which we can get into in a bit. And that discretion is both a good thing. It's allowed for a lot of experimentation. There are states that allow you to vote early on, where you would have, say, a 2-week or 3-week early voting period, because in the United States, our election day is on a Tuesday in November. It's cold in a lot of the country. Maybe there's snow on the ground. It's a work day. It's not a national holiday. And so there are states that have tried to make it easier to vote by allowing you to vote early or allowing you to vote by mail, etc. But there are states, because of the political parties that are in power, that do not want certain voters to be able to vote. And the United States has a long and tortured history of restricting the vote for certain racial minorities, obviously for women, who until 101 years ago were not able to vote, for disabled people, for large categories of voters that they found to be not in their political interests if they were able to turn out and cast a ballot.
So now let's get to the finances that influence the elections. When preparing for this interview, it seemed to me that the key to the debate on political financing in the US is the case Citizens United versus FEC. Can you explain to us what the case was and what it means for the political financing nowadays?
So in the United States, corporations have not been able to spend money on US elections. About 100 years ago, the United States Congress passed a law that said that corporations cannot give money directly to a candidate or their campaign for federal office. About 40 years after that, so about 70 years ago, they also said that corporations can't spend their own money independently of candidates in order to try and get them elected. And that was the law on the books for decades. This is something that was bipartisan. It was readopted, reapproved by a large majority of Congress in the 1970s after the largest political scandal we've had in modern day history in the United States, the Watergate scandals with President Nixon. The Congress came together and they reaffirmed that corporations should not be able to spend money directly in US elections. That was the law on the books. This is something that is supported by 70, 80, 90% of Americans think that should be the case. In 2010, a very slim majority of our U.S. Supreme Court, it has 9 members in a 5-4 decision, they said that corporations should be able to spend as much money as they want on U.S. elections, because if a corporation is spending money independently of a candidate, they're not coordinating with that candidate in their campaign, they're spending that money independently, not in coordination with them, then to restrict their ability to spend unlimited amounts of money would be akin to restricting their free speech. And so Citizens United basically had two big revolutionary concepts put in United States law and jurisprudence, which is that corporations have free speech rights. They have the same First Amendment free speech rights as living, breathing human beings. And Citizens United reaffirmed the idea that you cannot limit the amount of money that are spent in elections. And this has been gasoline on the fire of political spending in the United States. We could talk about how that money that goes into our elections has only grown over the last 11 years since Citizens United. But Citizens United is probably going to go down in history as one of the most wrong-headed, disastrous, naive, foolish decisions that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever made.
Do you actually have any numbers on how the finances going into the elections have risen since then?
The funny thing about money in U.S. politics is when I was growing up in the 90s, there was a Supreme Court case where one of the justices, a very famous Supreme Court justice in the United States, said, you know, what are we so concerned about money and politics? Americans spend more money going to the movies. They spend more money on chewing gum and candy than they do on elections. This is not a crisis. How very naive that thinking is now. This last election in 2020 between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, there was $14 billion spent for president and then both houses of Congress. $14 billion. The last time we had a presidential election in 2016 between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, it was $7 billion. So it has literally doubled in just the last 4 years alone. And it's not just about the amount of money, because those numbers in abstract, yes, they're overwhelming and huge and hard to wrap your mind around, but it's who is spending this money. Who are the folks who actually have the additional money laying around to be able to spend on federal elections? And when you dig into the numbers and the data here, you find that it's about 0.25% of the US population that spends about 70% of all that money. I think it was the Washington Post, one of our major newspapers here, that dug into how big the universe of people are that are influencing our elections. And they said that the most consequential spenders, the biggest spenders, could fit on one 747 airplane. It is a tiny group of people who we know are disproportionately white. It's disproportionately men. They are obviously disproportionately wealthy. They are disproportionately older. And this tiny group of Americans are exercising humongous outsized influence over the results of our elections.
Nearly $14 billion. That's how much all the US election campaigns for 2020 are reported to have cost.
By all accounts, the 2020 election will be the most expensive in history. Both presidential campaigns are raising and spending money by the millions, despite the ongoing pandemic and economic recession. It's part of a trend that sees each election more costly than the last.
That leads me to my other question. If I'm a voter in the US and I want to know how my candidate raised money for his campaign, whether he's transparent or not, how can I find such information?
So it's important to distinguish in the United States between what we call hard money and what we call soft money. Hard money is Jane Doe is running for senator and I like her platform, I like her ideas. And so I walk up to her and I say, I'd like to donate to your campaign. In the United States, I can donate almost $3,000 to her campaign, but that's the limit. I can give my money to other political committees who then in turn can donate to her campaign. But again, I can only give so much money to those organizations. I could give money, if she's a Democrat, to the Democratic Party. I could give money to the Republican Party. You know, and they will obviously spend money to support their candidates, but it is limited how much money I can actually, in hard cash, give to that candidate one way or another. What is not limited is soft money. And that's the amount of money that I, on my own, could spend $100 million on TV commercials, radio ads, taking out print ads, social media ads. That is totally unrestricted. And the Supreme Court has twice struck down attempts at restricting the amount of money that people can spend on elections independent of those candidates. And so that's where the real tragedy comes in. We can find hard money contributions pretty easily. There's a federal agency called the Federal Election Commission that is charged with regulating federal elections. They require all contributions to be reported to them. They put all that information online. If you want to know who gave to Jane Doe's campaign, you can go to the FEC's website, type in her name, and you will be able to see the name, address, occupation, amount donated from all of her contributors. But because there are a lot of wealthy spenders in the United States who don't want to appear on those online databases, they will instead give their money to what we call dark money organizations. And dark money organizations is where that contribution and that political money is not disclosed to the public. And so more and more, as time has gone on, especially after Citizens United in 2010, that political money is not going directly to the candidates or to the political parties. It is going to these dark money organizations and outside spending groups so as to evade disclosure.
And that leads us to a more systematic question. In the Czech Republic, if I want to support a political party or a candidate by a small donation, I just find a transparent banking account and send my money. But you've suggested that your system is quite different. There is something called a PAC and a super PAC. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so in broad strokes, once you get into the weeds, and I live in the weeds and it's a lonely place, once you get into the weeds, it's very complicated. So in broad strokes, a super PAC is basically an organization that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. And this comes from that Citizens United decision. Citizens United said, if you make expenditures that are independent of a candidate, then it is impossible to corrupt that candidate because you're not coordinating with them, you're not working with them, you're not planning with them. How can any amount of money spent independently of them actually lead to corruption or even the appearance of corruption? And so super PACs are those independent in air quotes, entities that are out there. They usually have innocuous sounding names like Americans for America, and people can give unlimited amounts of money to them. And then when they run TV ads, whether attacking a candidate or supporting a candidate, et cetera, all that will show up on the TV ad at the bottom will say, you know, paid for by Americans for America. And us as the voters, we don't get any more information than that. These organizations do have to disclose who their donors are because they are political organizations. They do have to show who their donors are and how much they gave, but all they have to do is list the names of their donors. They don't have to trace that back to the true source of the money. So we only get to go one level deep. So if I give money to an LLC or a nonprofit organization, and they give that money to the super PAC, people will never know that I was actually the original donor. All they'll see is the front group. And so we don't get full and complete transparency for super PACs.
Do you think that the system is rigged in some way, as you just described a bit? Is it beneficial for either party?
So I'll take that in two parts. There is no question, and this is the reason that there is such a vibrant and active pro-democracy campaign finance reform, anti-corruption community inside the United States, is because it is a fact at this point. It is proven that certain people have more power, more access, more influence, more ability to control the outcomes of elections than other people. I think of money in politics and campaign finance as the single largest issue that determines inequality in the United States. We know, we have the data that shows that wealthy people exert outside influence on these elections, that white, older, disproportionately male voters are the ones who are exerting the most influence. When it comes to whether these rules benefit one political party or the other, there's no question that if you are a third party, you're not a Democrat or Republican, that these rules are written to keep you out of the process. We actually have, in a number of states, closed primaries where the primary election, which is like the, you know, I always equate it to like a sports tournament. It's an early round, and whoever wins the primary gets to go on to the general election. They're actually closed so that only if you're a Democrat or Republican can you even vote in those elections. So we know that we disenfranchise independent or third party voters every year in the United States. When it comes to whether the rules benefit Republicans or Democrats, it used to be the case that many Democrats would say, oh, unlimited money in our federal elections, you know, corporations tend to spend money in favor of Republicans. So Citizens United and campaign finance rules, these are written to benefit Republican office holders and Republican candidates. But what we've seen in the last couple elections is that actually big money is going to support Democratic candidates more than it is Republicans. This last election, 2020, we saw $1 billion in dark money. That means money that was spent on political advertisements that influenced the election, where the voter had no idea where it was coming, where it was truly coming from. And the majority of that money came from organizations that supported Democrats. And we have a very prominent example from the 2020 elections of a single millionaire running for office, spending the equivalent of $1 million a day, independently funding his campaign and being able to essentially buy his way onto the debate stage, into the public space as a serious candidate in one of the primaries. So more and more, we're seeing that this big money system actually stands to benefit both Democrats and Republicans. And it really depends on who has the money and the active donor base as opposed to their political ideology.
I assume that the dark money is more apparent in the federal elections, but can you trace it even in the local elections?
So there is a lot of dark money that is spent at a state and local level too. And in fact, states have very diverse sets of rules about what political spenders have to disclose when. So some states like California and Montana have very strong dark money laws. Alaska just passed probably the strongest dark money law in the country this last cycle. It was a ballot initiative, so the voters got to weigh in on this. And we know that voters hate dark money. They are overwhelmingly in favor of strong transparency rules. But there are other states that don't require organizations that spend huge amounts of money to disclose who they're getting their money from. So in a lot of very important states that drive national policy or that have large voting bases, it's possible for a nonprofit organization or a corporation or the equivalent of a super PAC at a state level to spend five, tens, millions of dollars, which on a state level has a huge outcome. And they may spend it for their state legislature, they may spend it electing judges, which is something the United States does bizarrely. And so they can have a huge amount of influence with a relatively small amount of money. And it's ultimately up to the states whether they require all that spending to be reported and to be transparent. And it's very much a mixed bag.
Does anybody supervise the system?
On the federal level, that's the role of the Federal Election Commission. They're charged with overseeing federal elections, with enforcing the laws that we have on the books about federal elections, including transparency, contribution limits, etc. On a state level, it's a mixed bag. You know, there are some states that have very well-funded, very active enforcement bodies, and there are some states where it is relatively lax, where they don't have the appropriate funding, oversight, staff, etc., to be able to even find out where money is coming from, whether it has been accurately reported. And that is where, unfortunately, civil society organizations, media organizations, watchdog groups can play a huge role. They will be able to follow the money and do their own work to be able to find out about this spending, and most importantly, to be able to trace it and to be able to connect the dots to who the big spenders are, often from outside of those states. You know, it is a very small, you know, short list of cities in the United States that are basically paying for elections all across the country. You're going to have more money come out of Houston, Texas, and Dallas, Texas, for elections in small states. And more money was spent from Cleveland, Ohio, impacting elections in Alaska, than residents of Alaska spent on that. So that's where a lot of the media, civil society groups can play a great role, is being able to uncover and follow them.
So House Democrats are rethinking the entire U.S. voting system. They're pushing massive legislation, 791 pages to be exact, full of major changes to our elections.
Senator Joe Manchin announced he will vote against the For the People Act, essentially closing the door on Democrats' push for large-scale voting rights reform on Capitol Hill.
Do you, as a TIUS office, monitor the elections or the money going into the politics?
We certainly work on it as a reform issue. We are not an organization that spends money on candidates, but we have been very vocally supportive of the big bill that is moving through Congress right now, which would reform money in politics and a whole host of other issues. It's called the For the People Act, H.R. 1. This is something that is led by one of the largest coalitions of organizations in modern American history. It's got over 150, close to 200 civil society organizations that are supporting it. It would be truly transformative, immensely consequential for U.S. elections if this was able to pass, and Transparency International is a supporter of the bill.
Do you think it will pass?
In the United States, you know, we don't work with simple majorities in both of our houses of Congress. So in the Senate, the upper chamber, in order to get a piece of legislation passed, you essentially have to have 60 votes, not just 50. There's 100 members of the Senate. So you can't pass something if you just have 51 out of 100. You have to hit that 60 threshold. And because, unfortunately, H.R. 1 has become so partisanized, one of the major parties is blocking it in its entirety. And so the party that's been supporting it would need to pick up 10 members in order to cross that 60 vote threshold. They haven't been able to do it so far. There's been conversation about whether to change that rule so that a simple majority, as in many Western European countries, Australia, et cetera, where if they hit that simple majority, they're able to enact national legislation. And there's been a lot of focus and attention and advocacy efforts around changing the rule to make sure that important laws like H.R. 1 would be able to go into effect if they got a simple majority. President Biden has been vocally supportive of H.R. 1, and it does have the support of nearly every Democratic senator in the Senate. So if those rules were to change, either just for H.R. 1 or to get rid of that 50-vote threshold altogether, then we think that law has a great chance of becoming law.
Scott, thank you for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening. My name is Lucia, and I will return to the studio with our next foreign speaker.